Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary order. Thank you very much for being here this Monday morning. Nice sunny outside. We're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 215. So I'm going to go ahead and open up that public hearing. Whitney, if you'll give us an overview, please.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 215 directs the Oregon Health Authority to establish and operate a statewide database for collection and dissemination of orders for rare disease, emergency response medical treatment to ensure safe treatment. It also creates an Oregon Order Database Advisory Committee, and there are no amendments.
All right. Wonderful. I've got three individuals that are signed up. Jennifer, John, and Joseph. You wrong one?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask Joseph when I saw your name. I go, wow, that's interesting. I didn't know you're into that area. All right. So we'll take Joseph off. And so the other two, if y'all will come forward. While they're getting situated, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 215? All right. Jennifer, I assume you're going to start off?
Yes, thank you. So, good morning, Chairman Brzozinski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Jennifer Knapp. I live in Springfield, Oregon. I have a daughter with a rare disease who lives in South Eugene. I'm co-founder and director of Adrenal Insufficiency United, and I'm the Oregon Volunteer State Ambassador for the National Organization for Rare Disorders, which represents over 300 rare patient groups. Today, I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 215. Senate Bill 215 creates a database called ORDER, Orders for Rare Disease Emergency Response. One in 10 Oregonians have a rare disease. There are over 7,000 identified rare disease conditions, many of which require specialized care, which is different from the standard procedures of EMS agencies, emergency departments, and urgent care facilities. When healthcare personnel are unfamiliar with a rare disease and the treatment that is required, delays and mistakes can occur. In emergency and or surgical situations, the newly created database will give healthcare providers a tool to look up the orders of patients who may need this specialized care. Emergency department personnel will be able to read the specific orders submitted by the patient's care provider, and EMT will be able to call medical control and receive verbal instructions. Providing immediate access to these specific instructions will reduce complications and save lives. Some more important points. There are over 7,000 rare conditions, so even the most gifted healthcare provider will not be familiar with each and every rare or chronic condition. The concept for this bill comes purely from the rare disease community and our desperate need for help. We've seen too many preventable deaths and too much suffering. Our goal is not to place blame on medical professionals, but to help them by providing this valuable database tool. Patients will not be required to join. This is a voluntary program. The database is not a replacement, nor does it create a redundancy of existing disease databases or registries. Rather, this database will provide individualized orders for the patient from their physician. Many diseases are so rare that patients must travel outside of Oregon to find qualified physicians. In emergency situations, it will not always be possible to reach the patient's physician, and the precious time will be wasted. These delays in treatment can cost millions. About a year ago, a young woman suffered permanent brain damage and heart damage due to delayed treatment. For 9 months of her recovery, the state of California Medi-Cal program paid $97,000 per month. Now home, the monthly cost of her care is just under $17,000, again paid by the state. These amounts do not include the months she spent in a coma and intensive care, or the subsequent operations or neuromedications that may be needed due to the damage done to her heart. This young woman is only 25 years old. Before, she was an intelligent and vibrant young lady with her whole life ahead of her. Now she is severely disabled and requires 24-hour care. The payments the state must make to cover the cost of this care over her lifetime will exceed the cost of creating a database. Delays or mistakes in treatment can also cause death. Rare disease patients in our groups have died in preventable deaths in ambulances and hospitals when prompt and proper care was not given. A two-year-old died in the ER as the mother desperately tried to explain her daughter's rare condition. The ER doctor tried all the standard treatments, but the specialist who could have given the proper orders wasn't found in time. A database like this one creates would have saved their lives. We believe that our Oregon medical professionals want to save patients. This database will give them another tool to do so. We hope you will be part of the solution to this terrible reality that we feel as a deep-seated fear in the pit of our stomach. The fear that our loved one could be next. One in 10 Oregonians are living with a rare disease. That means we all know someone who will be directly affected by this bill. Oregon has led the way for Pulst. Now let us lead the way for order. Vote yes to advance Senate Bill 215 onto the next step in this legislative session, and tell your colleagues to support this bill all the way to the governor's office. I have a new sign-on letter with 18 different rare disease groups that represent people from Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. John?
Good morning, Chairman Prozanski and the rest of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is John Silver. Here to testify in support of Senate Bill 215, which creates a database called Order for Rare Disease Emergency Response. I'm a pulmonary critical care physician at Santiam Hospital out in state, and I direct their ICU and pulmonary inpatient services out there. The Santiam Hospital covers the area in the eastern Willamette Valley from Silverton down to Lebanon on the east side of I-5 up to the Salem Hospital catchment area. I'm also a volunteer medical advisor for Adrenal Insufficiency United, which has over 3,900 members and was started by Mrs. Knapp and Norgard to optimize and improve national standards of care for patients with adrenal insufficiency, particularly one of the rare disorders that's part of the NORD. I also have a rare medical disorder. I have primary adrenal insufficiency, also known as Addison's disease. It's the disease that President Kennedy had. I have an autoimmune form of primary adrenal insufficiency. Primary adrenal insufficiency is defined by the inability of your adrenal cortex to produce cortisol and fluticortisone, which are necessary for fluid and energy and salt homeostasis, and without those, people would die if you didn't have those hormones. And on normal days, when I take those, I'm doing well, and I'm vibrant and active, and I'm a father of five children, and I compete in 5Ks and do all those things. But the minute I get a viral gastroenteritis and I'm vomiting, then I have to inject intravenous hydrocortisone, and if I'm not able to do it myself, I have to go to the ER or have somebody inject for me. And so I'm vulnerable during those times, and the ER I'm going to, if I can't give them that information, they have to know that I have adrenal insufficiency or I could die. And people do die with the disease, anywhere from 8 to 15% of people who do go into adrenal crisis can die from their adrenal crisis if it's not recognized. Of my particular type of adrenal insufficiency, there are about only 400 Oregonians, so it's a very rare disease in the state of Oregon. It's about 1 in 100,000. So if you assume four to five million people, it's about 400 Oregonians that have it. Many patients with other rare disorders like Addison's, acute intermittent porphyria, acquired hemophilia, can have unusual presentations when they come to emergency rooms all around the country. And if you go to an academic emergency room or a busy community hospital like Salem or Santiam Hospital, the ER physicians may not have encountered people with some of these rare disorders. And yes, they can look it up on UpToDate, or they can do Google searches and figure out how to do things. But there are certain things that is a golden hour for resuscitation of people with these disorders. And if you don't get things done quickly, you wind up developing horrible morbidity and mortality, like the woman that was mentioned by Jennifer that had a cardiovascular arrest as a result of not getting her hydrocortisone immediately upon arrival and having a prolonged cardiovascular arrest and resuscitation, and then having prolonged and permanent brain injury as a result of that. So what we're hoping for as a result of SB 215 is to create this order set, this database for order. And as a result of something like that, we might be able to develop something that I've put on page 2 of what you have in OLIS, which would be a generalized kind of order set, so that if somebody like me goes to the emergency room, or some of these other patients that have rare disorders goes into an emergency room, that they would be able to, my name would pop up much like it does in the Pulse system, and they would be able to say, oh, that's patient X or Y, and if he's having a major crisis, he should get this type of drug or that type of drug. It would be a general guideline. It wouldn't tell the ER physician what he has to do or must do, but it would be a general guideline, and it would give some other descriptors maybe of the illness. Those kind of things can be worked out down the line once we develop the order set. But I think it would be very helpful to do, because there's this golden hour for resuscitation, and if you don't have that kind of information handily or easily available, you create more morbidity and mortality. And that's all I have to say.
All right. Thank you. I want to open it up for questions. Senator Manning first. Senator Thatcher next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. The database, I think it's a good idea. You know, I think it is have life-saving implications. But do you voluntarily go into this database, or how is that set up?
The concept would be that it would be a voluntary enrollment, so it would be a conversation between the patient and their physician to determine if the database would be helpful for them. Not everyone with a rare disease may need to be in the database, and so I think that would be up to the doctor and patient relationship if they want to enroll.
Much like POLST is. You know, I have patients that I've helped go on fill up POLST forms, and not all patients want to or need to, and some do, and it would be similar for order.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. I'm just trying to picture the how it would work. Would somebody have a medical alert jewelry on them that directs them to go look at a database, or how would they know to look at the database? Unless they did it for every person?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure out how it
Thank
would work.
Thank you. That's a good question. The committee that we're setting up, the advisory, I think would set up those things, but I know the thoughts that we've had is that it would be something on a medical alert bracelet. Perhaps there would be a number that said order 592 or something, and then you go into the ER and they can look you up, or perhaps a wallet card or some kind of identification like that. Again, you know, similar to how POLST is set up. The director of POLST is willing to help advise on this committee to, you know, have it kind of as a parallel program or look at the ways that POLST has been successful and transfer that into this program.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
So at this point, I'm going to ask once again, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 215? Not seeing anyone. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And at this point, we are going to...
Why don't we do a work session on 257 or 2?
Okay. And we've got this one up, too. Yeah, Joseph is.
Oh, okay.
That's why I surprised
him. Okay.
All right. Joseph, I know you're here on 898. I'm going to go ahead and open up my public hearing on that.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
And we'll get you on to the... if you haven't signed up, if Lisa, is the 898 still there? Yeah, that way we have the formal record.
Thank you.
You bet. So I'm going to go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 898. Whitney, if you'll give us an overview, please.
Thank you, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 898 creates the Task Force on Custody and Parenting Time. The task force would sunset December 31st, 2018. There are no amendments, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
All right. Joseph?
Hello. Thank you for seeing me today. My name is Joseph Cowles. I reside in Eugene. I first brought this to Senator Przonski's attention, and we had created a work group to create a bill. The bill was, from my understanding, was going to be based off of the Illinois statutes. We're going to model the bill after that. However, when the bill was presented, I think that was too strong of a shift in the paradigm. I think what the end goal is to remove the term custody, as it's an inflammatory term. It's a zero-sum game. If when it goes to a custody dispute, one parent is awarded custody, the other parent is legally disenfranchised from their child. The word custody, as you know, means imprisonment, and when a prisoner is taken into custody, they get periodic visitations. These aren't the types of terms we should be using in family law and with our families. So the proposal is, or the long-term goal for me, is to remove the word custody and replace it with the definition of custody. And the definition is decision-making, major decision-making responsibilities. So if we were able to scrub the statutes in Oregon state law of the term custody, replace it with major decision-making responsibilities, peel back the onion a little further, what are those decisions? They're education, healthcare, religion, and residence. So the proposal, or my original proposal, was to give the court the ability to tailor fit parenting arrangements instead of an all or nothing or a zero sum game. If father, for example, if father's an educator and mother is in healthcare, well, then maybe father would be better suited to make the decisions regarding education and mother regarding healthcare. With custody, sole custody, the one parent is, of course, awarded all of the decision-making responsibility, and the other parent is legally disenfranchised from their own child when they've done nothing wrong. And I think there's room for improvement. The state of Illinois had passed a bill in 2015. It went into effect January 1st, 2016, and that bill was to do exactly that, remove, scrub all the statutes of the word custody, replace it with decision-making responsibilities, defining those decisions, and then allocating each of those decisions to the best fit parent. And by doing so, you're preserving the integrity of the family, the balance in family. Just because it didn't work out between two parents should not suggest that one parent should be, in a way, pushed out. We need to preserve the integrity and balance of family for our children. And that's really the premise of why I'm here.
All right. So just to give it a little framework, Joseph and I met some years back.
Yeah.
Senator Edwards was his constituent. Our senator, right?
Yes, yes, and, so, and I had started with Representative Nancy Nathanson and Senator Edwards.
Yeah, and so I only bring that up because Senator Manning is now on our committee, and if you're still living in the same area, there's your senator.
Welcome.
And so we've met multiple times over the years, and there's been, of course, a lot of let's say frustration on Joseph's part, even on my part, as to how this has been handled or not handled through work groups and stuff. And so, but I do want to just clarify, right now the only thing I see that's on file is the original bill. And it sounded like in your testimony, Joseph, you're talking about maybe modifying the bill from a work group and just wanting to try to do something and changing the terminology, or was that something you're just saying that this is something the work group should be taking up as part of the
So are we talking about the original work group that
I'm looking at the bill now as 898.
Yeah.
You know, if what it says is, you know, the relating clause is relating to domestic relations proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
And so
from my understanding, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interject. So from my understanding, in December was the last time the work group met. And we left the work group in agreement that the bill, what is now Bill 898, would be modeled after the Illinois statutes. However, when the bill was produced, Ms. Newell had contacted me and said, well, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is the bill, we did draft a bill. The bad news is it's not modeled after the Illinois statutes. My understanding is it was too strong of a shift in the paradigm. They want to study more law and the effects of what we're suggesting. And, you know, now that precedence has been set in the state of Illinois, maybe, you know, that would be something we'd study. But so in the evolution of the work group, it went from modeling after the Illinois statutes to this proposed bill with the task force. And in my humble opinion, it's, you know, we created the work group to then possibly create another work group, and it doesn't feel like we're making a lot of progress, but I'm in it for the long haul, so I would love to be part of this task force, and I know that's appointed by the governor if the bill passes.
I'm looking at how the appointment is, and...
But I think it's...
The way it's set up now, there would be room for an individual...
Member C, I think it is, the non-custodial parent.
There's the B and C, it looks like. All right. Okay, so any other questions for Joseph? All right. Thank you very much, and thanks for the clarification as to basically the example that you're giving is where the work group had worked as to whether or not they should or shouldn't. So does the Illinois statute actually remove the terminology of custody
completely?
Okay. All right.
Yeah, and they replace it with decision-making responsibilities, and then the allocation of those decision-making responsibilities to the most appropriate parent. So, in essence, the court and a judge can tailor fit a parenting arrangement on a case-by-case basis as opposed to a zero-sum game.
All right. All right. If there's no other questions or comments,
I don't know if that's a question, but it looks like the bill is geared towards arriving or just studying one type of change in law. That's kind of how I read it. It's kind of like what you're saying. Let's look into the Illinois model, and that's kind of what the task force is about. It's not necessarily looking at other things that may work in other states that may have also changed the paradigm a little bit, such as what's called equal parenting time, where you start with that. I just wondered if that's something that you would consider, you know, just looking at all of the different changes out there rather than just the one.
The attorney who championed this bill to get passed in Illinois, that was part of it as well, the equal parenting time. And there need to be good reason why there wouldn't be equal parenting time. So that that would be, I think, an improvement as well. So I think that'd be beneficial.
Well, when we first started this conversation some years back, Joseph broached the subject of joint assumed or presumed joint custody. So equal time.
Yeah.
So as this evolved, that wasn't flying. And in fact, the work group was going to be disbanded if we kept talking about joint custody. And then all of a sudden, coincidentally, so we're studying, I think, the statutes of Florida, Texas, and New Mexico. And we're trying to form a bill that would kind of take the best of those three state laws. And coincidentally, the Illinois statutes or the Illinois bill was passed. And then Dr. Peterson had brought it to our attention at one of the work group meetings, and it was a huge development. And so then we agreed as a work group to start forming the bill after that, the Illinois statutes, as that had was a new development in the process. So that was kind of the evolution of it. And it also mentions in this bill that it talks about visitation and scrubbing state law, the statutes of visitation also. And I thought that had already happened. So we're halfway there. Visitation has gone away. And I firmly feel that custody would, if custody went away and we replaced it with decision-making responsibilities, tailor-fit each parenting arrangement on a case-by-case basis, it would benefit the families in our state and the children mainly.
All right, Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to kind of follow up on the vice chair, what she was talking about. I'm assuming that we're speaking about SB 550, which is, I'm also a co-sponsor of that bill, and that's about equal parenting time. And you alluded a little bit that initially that was part of the conversation, but you had to withdraw from that in order to get to this point. Is there a chance now, the way the wording is, because SB 550 is worded similar to what you're talking about, is there and I was looking down who is going to be involved in this, is there a way to include one of the proponents of SB 550 in here? Because I noticed that they have a cross-section of people that's involved, and maybe we don't need two bills then. We can get this all done at one time.
We can consolidate it into one bill, and I must admit I wasn't aware of SB 550, so that's great news to me. And I think there's pros and cons to that. If we were able to consolidate it into one bill, there might be more pushback for one or for the bill in general as opposed to two separate bills. But I think in the long term, I mean, if it's feasible to consolidate it and it gets passed, great. But my concern would be that there might be too much resistance on one to affect the other if it's consolidated. But
well, we can talk about it.
I think it's a great idea if it gets passed.
Yeah, the vice chair is the chief sponsor of that bill, right?
Yeah.
Don't kill it.
And thank you for that, because I was unaware of that, Senator Manning.
No, I mean, I think
sponsor it.
Yeah.
All right. Other questions or comments? All right. Joseph, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony this morning on SB 898? Not
Thank you for your time.
You betcha. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. We're going to hold on to this. We're going to kind of do some discussions. It does have a subsequent to Ways and Means, and so that's where it would be headed if we pass it at this point. Chair's going to make some inquiries, and we're going to potentially see if we want to make any modification to the current bill in conjunction with the language that's in 550. And I think maybe what we'd be looking at is just opening it up as to making sure the task force could go beyond what's in the issue on 898, so there'd be a little bit more flexibility. And people wouldn't think, well, that's all you can talk about is just the Illinois model. All right. So with that, we've closed the public hearing.
Hey, Professor Benson, give you my card.
No, give it to Lisa, please. Thank you. Just formalities.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Joseph.
Thank you.
All right. So this brings us to our next public hearing, which is going to be Senate Bill 1014.
Thank you.
And what I'm going to go ahead and do is go ahead and open up a public hearing on 1014. And first say, I believe possibly Senator Farioli may be making an appearance on this bill. At least at a couple of weeks ago, he was scheduled to do so. And we don't have anyone scheduled that signed up. I understand there's definitely people in the room that are going to want to talk. First, let me go ahead and have Whitney open it up. And then, Rob, I think I'm going to take you up on your offer to have you come in. Did you? No, you're coming in on the on 323. Never mind. Time out. My fault. It's Monday morning. All right. So go ahead and give us that. And then, Anthony, you can come on up.
Thank you, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1014 was brought to us by Senator Farioli. Senate Bill 1014 allows law enforcement agencies to transfer forfeited marijuana items to nonprofit medical marijuana dispensaries. This marijuana can then be dispensed to registry identification cardholders with annual income at or below the federal poverty guidelines. There are no amendments.
All right. Anthony, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony when you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name for the record is Anthony Taylor. I'm the president and co-founder of Compassionate Oregon, a patient advocacy group for medical cannabis patients. And I'm sorry I don't have any prepared testimony for y'all to follow along on, but let me first applaud the efforts of this bill to try and deal with, one, the issue of what to do with some of this confiscated cannabis, and two, its efforts to get that cannabis to low-income patients. The first part of the bill, section one, where it talks about when an officer arrests a person for violation of ORS 475B.010 to .395, I think we should include in that also ORS 475B.490 sub 2, where any property interest possessed, owned, or used in connection with the medical use of cannabis incidental that has been seized by the state and local law enforcement officers. And this is where the language I think we really need to include as part of this bill, because this subsection requires officers to not harm, neglect, injure, or destroy while in the possession of law enforcement agency, except that they have no responsibility to maintain live plants. I think this is a good way to go with this proposal. It's tricky because where do we hold it? How do we hold it? How long do we hold it? And all those things impact its marketability once it's been, once there's been a conviction entered and the product is allowed to be dealt with. So there are a lot of issues here that I think could be resolved fairly easily and would help to make this bill a much better bill. The testing part, of course, is critical. We test all the cannabis that comes into the system now, and we should continue with that, although it's hard to say that the nonprofit dispensary should be saddled with that burden. Perhaps we should look at some language that would help subsidize that burden. Testing is fairly expensive these days, and they're nonprofit trying to get stuff out as free as possible to these others. The other thing is there really are no nonprofit dispensaries right now, and that's problematic in this, but I think we can solve that by simply allowing it to be dispersed to the OLCC licensed retail outlets, because they're allowed to give away free marijuana under the rules. So perhaps that's the better entry point for this product. And again, I'm not sure how it's going to work quite, what the mechanism is going to be. I know that law enforcement would probably have concerns on, you know, what their role is, how do they go about storing and all of this, and making sure that the product is still viable once it's allowed to be dispersed. The other thing is it should be allowed to be sent to processing sites too, because some of this product that may sit around for a year or so before a conviction is entered may not be marketable as good flower. It might have, you know, it's aged, it's may be less than desirable for the market, but allowing it to go to processors would help with that, because of course, you know, you can convert just about any kind of product into oils and some of the other high potency product. So I think it's great that we have this bill in front of everybody. I just think it needs just a little bit more work before we send it forward. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions, Senator Manning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have, after reading this bill, I have some concerns about some of the things in here, and you just raised a number of issues. So in your opinion, one is that the way it reads, and I assume that this is current law, is that if the marijuana is found on in possession of someone in their home or in a vehicle, then those can also be confiscated. But as you indicated, that you feel that this bill is not even ready to come forward. So I'm assuming that you're planning on doing a dash amendment and submit that?
Chairman Przanski, Senator Manning, I have spoken with Senator Farioli's office and offered some suggestions. I just haven't checked back in with them this week, so I don't know what the status of that is.
Okay, so the other part about it is that it seems like now with this bill, or the intent of this bill, that is going to put an additional layer on law enforcement, which they may not be in a position to take care of right now, you know, in terms of storing the evidence and how long the evidence is going to take to go to trial, and whether or not that evidence after that will even be something that's viable. So do you have an idea about what is a timeline involved in this in order to recover this? And the other piece is that you say there's no nonprofit, but it's going to go to a for-profit marijuana dispensary. Do you think that's a good thing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Manning, I'm not qualified, of course, to speak to what law enforcement might think about this. However, 475-490 has been in place for almost 2 years now, and I don't know if they've handled any cases with respect to that section and subsection, but I do know that it's tricky, I would imagine, for them to do this. And like I said, I don't know if they've confiscated or seized any product under the medical part of it, but I'm sure if they have, there's already some protocol in place to deal with it.
Thank you, sir. All right, so let just put on the record, I mean, as you well know, Senator Manning, the evidence is going to be taken and it's going to be stored until the case is disposed, and so there wouldn't be any additional requirement, at least as far as I can tell, that would require any special type of storage. There'd probably be best practices that would be given to the agencies to try to maintain the continuity of it. But at this point, you know, pretty much storage is storage. There's other questions, I think, as you've mentioned, and as Mr. Taylor's also mentioned, that we'd have to be getting through, and I know that there's is definitely from law enforcement, at least from some components, some pushback as to how that would work with having dual jurisdiction between the state and the feds regulating, and how we may allow for this type of conduct and activity, but under the federal law, it doesn't. Okay. All right. Senator Dimbrow, no?
No.
All right. Anthony, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I see we have two senators on the front row. I assume Senator Farioli and Senator Burdick both would like to come up and give us a little words of wisdom on Senate Bill 1014.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ted Farioli, District 30. Initially a reluctant member of the Marijuana Committee, along with your illustrious chair. What we have today, Senate Bill 1014, I think solves a couple of problems, or at least is an attempt. One is that it allows law enforcement to transfer seized cannabis from an illicit grow to a nonprofit dispensary. Nonprofit dispensaries already exist in statute, so we're not creating that. It's part of the medical program. The nonprofit dispensary would need to ensure that the marijuana they receive in this matter is tested, of course, for potency and lack of contaminants. And then this cannabis would come to those dispensaries for use by medical patients. This is another issue that we're encountering. Not only do we believe that there's going to be seizures from illicit grows, but we also believe that most of the dispensaries that were licensed during the first year of operation or prior to the implementation of Measure 91 have now migrated to the recreational side, leaving only a few in relative terms of dispensaries still available that exclusively provide for medical patients. They are reporting difficulty in obtaining a product for their patients. So this is aimed at helping to solve or reduce that problem. At the other end of this consideration, we intend to also propose that anyone holding an Oregon license also become a mandatory reporter. That is not contained in this bill, nor are these concepts connected. It's just the idea that we believe there's considerable leakage from the medical system into the illicit market. If folks were mandatory reporters, this would create, in my estimation, a relatively large flow of seized cannabis that could then be diverted back into the medical dispensaries, helping to alleviate the supply problem. We're offering the bill for your consideration. I don't expect that this bill will arrive at our committee or on the floor without amendment. It will be amended. There's no question about that. And Senator, to Mr. Chairman, to your question about the need to store the cannabis, I'll defer to folks who have a better handle on the chain of evidence, which would be you. But my estimation is that currently an amount of the cannabis that's seized is sampled and stored for further prosecution if that becomes an opportunity. The rest is usually burned. I would suggest we'll accomplish the same objective, but the burning will happen as cannabis patients consume it. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ginny Burdick. I represent the people of Senate District 18. And I also chair the, I co-chair the Committee on Marijuana Legalization. And Senator Farioli is my honorable vice chair.
Co-vice chair.
Yes, we have co here. I have testimony that I submitted to the record, which is on OLIS, but I just wanted to point out that this bill is really in response to some of the disruptions to the medical community that have arisen as a consequence of legalization of cannabis. Under the strictly medical system we had, growers would grow for patients and give it, basically in many cases provide free cannabis to their patients. And then in order to make ends meet, they would have authorization from those patients to sell the remaining cannabis into the dispensary system. And of course, with dispensaries going down, of course, we all know that some of it did not end up in dispensaries. It ended up in the black market. But we, with the decline in medical dispensaries, the you know, some people have pointed out that some of the medical patients, especially the low-income ones, have been stranded. And this would help address that problem. We have other strategies that we're using to try to get cannabis to patients who can't afford it. But this is one more method of getting what people regard as medicine to the people who can't afford it. So I urge your support for Senate Bill 1014. I'm glad it's in this committee because we want to make sure it's done right. And I know that this committee will work it very thoughtfully with our marijuana legalization co-chair as the chair of this committee. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions for the senators? Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you.
Rob, you've positioned yourself onto the front row. That tells me that you might want to also give comment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovette, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties, mostly just to offer my assistance with Senator Ferry's Oley's office if he's looking at amendments. This bill, fortunately or unfortunately, has a very narrow relating to clause. It's relating to forfeiture of marijuana items. Most marijuana that law enforcement seizes in Oregon is not seized for civil forfeiture. It's just seized as evidence. So there's only a narrow band of cases that we can address in this statute. So I'm happy to help look at some of the options we can use this bill for and participate to the extent folks want me to.
All right, great. Thank you. Questions? All right. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1014? Not seeing anyone. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 1014. And this is going to take us into work sessions. And Ryan, if you'll stay after we get this, I can put some stuff on the record, and we'll take care of it that way. All right. So work sessions, we're going to go ahead and start with the 257?
Sure.
All right. Open up the work session on 257. Whitney?
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. Senate Bill 257 was brought to us by Senator Gelser. We previously heard this bill on March 9th. Since that time, we did get in a Dash 2 amendment. The original bill expands the crime of official misconduct in the first degree to include acts that constitute official misconduct in the second degree when the violation places another in danger of physical injury or damages property of another. We now have the Dash 2 amendment. The Dash 2 makes this offense applicable to violations when the public servant is aware of and consciously disregards a risk that the violation will place a vulnerable person in danger of physical injury or a sex crime, or the violation will cause the withholding of necessary and adequate food, physical care, or medical attention. There is no revenue, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
All right. There was a Dash 1, but the Dash 2 is the one that we're moving, correct? All right. Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 257.
Senator Thatcher moves the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 257. Discussion.
Can you give me the date we first heard that again?
Yes, it was March 9th. And we had the Dash 1 on March 9th. The Dash 2 is the only thing that's come out since the hearing.
Any other questions or any comments?
Well, just one comment. The Dash 2s are dated themselves are March 22nd, 2017. I didn't have that date in front of me when I initially moved the amendment, just okay. So there's clarification there.
And Senator Lithcombe, did you have any follow-up based on?
No, I think when you go to look for approval, I will object, but
okay.
I have no other questions. I found it here in my notes.
All right. Any other questions or comments? So the motion before us is to adopt the Dash 2 amendment and to Senate Bill 257. That amendment is dated March 22nd of this year. And Senator Lilliken, were you opposing the Dash 2s, or are you waiting until we go to the bill?
I'll wait till you go with the bill.
All right. So there's no objection to the, amending the bill with the Dash 2s. So ordered. And now, Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 257 as amended with the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 257 as amended by the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Lithgow, did you want to follow up on or?
I have some hesitancy with regard to how the Dash 2 is laid out, actually the whole bill and it's encompassing, and so okay. I'll reserve the right to object today, and we'll see it as it moves forward.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, just to say, I appreciate the narrowing. And it's more specific as to what they're talking about, because it seemed like it was really wide at first. And not that I would be totally objecting to that point, if that's really where we want to go, but I think there were some cases in mind when this bill was written, and I think that a Dash 2 amendment points at those.
Yeah.
So.
And I agree with your assessment on the original bill, and that's why there was some work done. And I believe that the way it's been framed with the Dash 2s, it clearly makes it much more narrow and specific for a certain group of people and doesn't overwhelm the current practices that we have in this area. Senator Denbrough, did you comment?
Yeah, I just want to say I do appreciate the narrowing, and I feel much more comfortable with the bill now. And, you know, I think this that it calls for the violation requires demonstration that the individual is aware of and consciously disregards the risk. That seems like a pretty high bar to have to prove. So I feel comfortable with that.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. It seems to me the way it is set for, it's not I gotcha type of legislation. It's one where there's going to have to be shown some type of knowledge / intent on the part of the person doing something that caused these type of injuries. Any other comments or questions? All right. At this point, the motion passes with Senator Lithicum objecting. And with that, we'll go ahead and close the work session. The carrier will be Senator Gelser on that bill. We'll go ahead and open up our last work session we have scheduled for today, Senate Bill 323. And Whitney, why don't you give us an overview?
Yes, thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 323 was brought to us by Senator Olson. We previously heard this bill on February 16th. Senate Bill 323 was expanding the crime of arson in the first and second degree to include causing a fire or explosion because of knowingly manufacturing a controlled substance. There is a Dash 1 amendment that to focus on, that, which replaces the measure, creates a new offense of arson incident to the manufacture of a controlled substance in the first and second degree. The second degree offense is a C felony, and the first degree offense is an A felony. The offense applies to fires or explosions that damage property or cause serious injury to a firefighter or peace officer while acting in the line of duty related to the fire as a result of the knowing manufacture of a controlled substance. There is no revenue impact. We just got in the fiscal impact, so it is not yet on OLIS. The fiscal impact, there is a note from them that the measure is anticipated to have a minimal fiscal impact to state agencies and does not require referral to Ways and Means. While this measure does not require an appropriation at this time, there could be a cumulative effect of the measure with a prison or local control population impact and may require further analysis and adjustments to state agency appropriations. So, again, they seem to be indicating that it is a minimal at this time, but that there could be a cumulative effect. I think they put in that the Criminal Justice Commission estimates the creation of this crime in the first degree may result in 4 felony convictions a year.
All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Rob Ouellette to come forward. He will give us some little direction on the Dash 1 amendment. Let me just kind of put on the record, if you remember, Senator Olson brought the bill to us, and when we first heard the bill, it was very broad and it was having conflict with the work that was being done and had already been done on the regulation of marijuana for recreational purposes. And so that's why it got sidetracked, and then there were some discussions that took place. Rob, why don't you pick up from there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties. That is, in fact, the case. So this bill is really designed to address clandestine meth labs that catch fire or blow up. The reality is that almost all clandestine drug labs in Oregon fall into one or two categories, meth or BHO. Meth we addressed in 2005 with legislation that the chair helped me with, House Bill 2485. That's still on the books. BHO we've addressed in Senate Bill 302A, which has passed the Senate and is now on the House floor. So what does that leave? It leaves what I call the exotics, things like GHB, MDMA, various exotic labs that we generally see about one or two incidents a year. So we crafted the Dash 1 amendments to basically fill the gap, the remaining gap. It should have minimal to no fiscal impact, even cumulatively, because we really are only talking about one or two labs a year. So with the Dash 1 amendments, this is a good bill and should pass. It really is just filling that narrow gap of clandestine drug labs that don't fit into one of the two major categories.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Dimbrough first.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Rob, so it's been a while since we had the hearing, and I've kind of lost track on what I thought of, of this. But a person who's going to be convicted of this would be convicted of another crime as well, right? I'm just wondering why the necessity of adding this penalty to the other.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dimbrough, indeed they would likely be convicted of manufacture of a controlled substance, but generally, depending on what the substance is and what they're doing, that is a crime that is not ranked very high. It's generally presumptive probation, and so folks that actually catch a lab on fire and blow something up, and the A felony in this case would be blowing up generally a first responder. We enacted in 2005 a bill that addressed that in the context of meth labs, when you do really big harm, more than just a normal manufacture. And that took care of what at that time was about 90% of all of our labs. 302A will take care of what is unfortunately a growing trend in Oregon, which is BHO labs. But again, we'll still have those one or two dimethyltryptamine, methylene dioxymethamphetamine, GHB. Again, this is what I would call real chemistry, test tubes, flask, beakers, and when they're blowing something up like a house or a person, just a simple charge of manufacture of a controlled substance is really weak. And so we probably ought to create some level of parity among all of the clandestine meth labs. And this bill with the Dash 1 amendments would fill that gap. But probably importantly to know, I can't speak for Gail, but she's here, we worked on these Dash amendments to make sure it didn't get amended into the Arson 1 statute, which is potentially a Measure 11 offense. So we're doing what essentially we've done with BHO, which is create the upper level felonies but not require mandatory prison for it.
Yeah, and I think that's – thank you for that explanation at the end. I think that really sets it apart that we're going to hold them accountable, but based on the scenario of someone going and they say intentionally setting an arson, knowing that's what their job and their task is, as compared to someone that's doing something they shouldn't be doing, that results in that type of situation. Senator Lithicum.
Just to follow on with regard to that, the language for, quote, blowing up a house and whatever, the guideline at $750 sounds minimal. They we're out of step there. So I'm wondering if that's related to the Measure 11 arson. Is there a monetary distinction there or whatever? But $750 is relatively minor, if you will, and yet the language we're using is blowing up a neighborhood.
Mr. Chair and Senator Linthicum, actually, the Dash Ones have two sections. One is basically the verbatim equivalent of Arson One, and then the other one is the verbatim equivalent of Arson Two. So Measure 11 is only impacted under Arson One when you're injuring a person. So that's where Measure 11 is implicated. So for BHO, a marijuana-type extraction labs that are legal and catch fire and blow up, we did essentially write equivalent statutes to Arson 1 and Arson 2, except no Measure 11 implication. The Dash 1 amendment here would do the same with regard to all the exotic labs, but again, with no Measure 11 implication. So the $750 threshold you're talking about can basically separate the Arson 1 equivalent from the Arson 2 equivalent, but again, without a mandatory minimum prison sentence. I hope that helps in some way.
Okay. All right. Any other questions or comments? All right. Since I've opened it up to allow Rob an opportunity to explain the amendments, I will ask, Gail, did you have any comments or... Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Now, if you had something to put on the record, fine. If you don't, then we'll move forward.
I would like to put something on the record.
Never give up an opportunity.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Przonski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We actually are kind of grateful for this outcome in the Dash 1. The original proposal was to go into the Arson 1 and Arson 2 statutes and input the exotics, as Rob calls them, into those two existing statutes. Our concern for that is Arson 1 is by specific statutory reference a Measure 11 crime, and we wanted to avoid a mandatory minimum. So instead, these are now two freestanding new statutes, the crime of arson incident to the manufacture of a controlled substance, and as such, there is no reference to Measure 11, and so then, therefore, they're not mandatory minimum sentences, and we like that.
All right. Any questions? Gail, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. With that, at this point, we would need to adopt the Dash 1 amendment.
All right, Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment dated March 27, 2017, to Senate Bill 323.
Senator Thatcher moves the Dash 1 amendment into Senate Bill 323. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 323 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 323 as amended by the Dash Ones to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Again, discussion? Any objections? So ordered. We'll have Senator Olson carry the bill to the floor since he was the primary sponsor. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 323.
We get a carry here for 257.
We did, and that is Gelser.
Okay.
I'll put that on afterwards. All right, so that concludes the work we have today. Now I want to take an opportunity to put some stuff on the record. Prior to Friday afternoon, we actually had another bill scheduled for a hearing today, Senate Bill 1031. Looking at the posting, we did a revision number 2 that was posted on Friday at 2:09, stating that we were taking that off, and we did, in fact, take that off. Unfortunately, an individual has traveled here from California, from my understanding, to give testimony on that, not realizing that the bill had been taken off the docket on Friday. We've checked with the Secretary of the Senate. We are not able to actually formally take testimony either or do even an informational hearing because it's not posted. So what I've asked is Ryan Trivett is one of the individuals as an advocate for the bill. His client or witness is here. If those who are here would like to have a conversation with him or they want to reach out, you might be able to catch some of the members since we have some time left in our committee that we're going to be adjourning. I don't know what their schedule is, but I just wanted to put that on the record. I'm really sorry that this has happened, but because of the protocol and the rules that we have, we are not able to actually formally take testimony today. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the committee. We're scheduled to meet at 8, and I guess the last thing I would suggest is that the reason I will put on the record 1031 was pulled is because there has been extensive work done on the House with another bill or bills over there. I'm not sure what those numbers are. And I was convinced on Friday, based on comments that came in from multiple parties that have been involved in the discussions and negotiations on the House side, that they thought it would be best to allow that to move forward and not to go forward at this point with 1031. So at this point, we're not planning on posting it in the future. We may post it. We'll have until the end of this week to actually get it posted if we need to. But we are, I know that there's been extensive work done on the other side, and it's hard for me to justify doing competing bills with that much work already in. So at this point, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn for the day, and we're scheduled to be here tomorrow at 8. Thank you. And we're scheduled to be here tomorrow at 8. Thank you.